Hello and welcome to Contact Chai. Today's episode is a Shabbat replay of our Saturday morning service on March 16th. Rabbi Stephen compared and contrasted Purim, a holiday which centers a satirical story and power fantasy, with modern realities of Jewish power. In a year when the Megillah's violent vengeance may hit close to home, how can we celebrate Purim thoughtfully? Take it away, Rabbi.
So for us Jews, the classic holiday formula goes, they tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat.
That's right.
Which is, I believe, a passable summary of the Purim story if we ignore the penultimate chapter. Because between our enemies plotting to murder every last Jew in Persia and our mandate to celebrate having made it out alive is a war. The problem is this. The king had already ratified the decree to kill us. And in the Persian legal system of the time, once a law was made, it could not be unmade. So the solution was a second decree, that if anyone attacked us, the Jews could fight back. And not only fight back, but lehashmid, leharog, leaved, or destroy, massacre, annihilate. They begin with Haman. Or practice. Thank you. I was like, this is your practice, folks. They begin with Haman, the master. We'll do it one time. The mastermind of the plot. His 10 sons are executed next. In Shushan, the royal capital, they kill 500 people. And the following day, 300 more. And soon violence spreads across the Persian Empire with a final tally of 75,000 people killed in our defense. We are told that the Persians came to dread the Jews. The word used here, pachad, is more than just fear, but an existential terror, an activation of our most primal instinct to survive at all costs. And so now, let's eat. It's not really a story that engenders much of an appetite. Purim is a rabbinic holiday, which means that rather than being prescribed by the Torah, like Passover or Rosh Hashanah, it was developed by the rabbis sometime between the consecration of the Second Temple in 516 BCE and its destruction in 70 CE. Its companion is Hanukkah, which commemorates another martial victory against impossible odds. Rabbinic holidays share a couple of features. They're stories of miraculous outcomes, of a small people overcoming some of the greatest empires of antiquity, of finding power where everyone had perceived impotency, of, as stated in the Megillah, the book of Esther, b'nahafochu, everything that we thought we knew being turned on its head. These are holidays created by people living under the oppressive regimes of Persia, of Macedonia, and Rome, dreamed up by scholars who could not imagine lifting a sword against their military supremacy, especially after two disastrous rebellions that had left the Second Temple in ruins and Jerusalem razed to the ground. This is why the rabbis write regarding the civil war that ends the Purim story, in this world, has there ever been a moment like this, when Jews were not only able to defend ourselves, but to do with our enemies as we wished? It's telling that Haman, the villain of our story, is introduced as an Agagi, a descendant of Agag, king of the Amalekites. In the rabbinic imagination, Amalek is a metonym for every person or group of people who have sought to oppress, displace, or exterminate Jews, Babylonian or Roman, Cossack or Nazi. When we read the Megillah, we drown out every mention of Haman by name as an active fulfillment of the biblical commandment found in Deuteronomy to blot out the memory of Amalek. And it's not just because he's an unpleasant character. But among his many disturbing qualities, Haman operates from a hatred that bears a startling resemblance to contemporary anti-Semitism. There is a certain people, he whispers in King Ahasuerus's ear, scattered and dispersed among the rest of us, who follow laws different from our own and disobey the authority of the king. Writing in the 16th century, Rabbi Yosef ibn Yahya connects these words to the anti-Jewish sentiment of his time, that Jews are deceptive, insular, more loyal to ourselves than to others who refuse to assimilate, but have also infiltrated society, a dangerous fifth column. We see in Haman an archetypical anti-Semitism that has found expression in every place and time, including our own. And in King Ahasuerus, we see the apathy or the inability of those in power to protect us from it. The Purim story is a fantasy, one in which we not only survive, but we fight back. And for millennia, it was a chance for Jews to indulge in the improbable, that we could not only be the victims of violence, but able to perpetrate it in kind. Purim is a fairy tale, if a vengeful one, told again and again against the backdrop of statelessness and pogroms and genocide, forgivable, if not understandable, because it was so far from our reality. For most of our history, the idea of Jewish power was absurd. Even the Maccabean revolt, which we celebrate on Hanukkah, ended, according to most records, in a semi-autonomous state embedded within the disintegrating Seleucid Empire, not the triumphalist vision of independence that our tradition envisions. And this tenuous status lasted less than a century, and then the Romans stepped in. Our self-conception informed by this reality is one of smallness, of transience, of living alongside and at the behest of other peoples. And it's in a way, it's how we always have thought of ourselves. We are the descendants of second sons, the tent dwellers, the thinkers, the dreamers, not the hunters, but the hunted, not the warriors, but those who fall by their sword. But then enter the golden age of American Jews, and to a degree, global Jewry as well, a period spanning from the close of World War II into the first decades of this century. It is a time, as described by Franklin Foer in a recent edition of The Atlantic, I'm seeing nods, this article that made its way around our community, brought about by liberalism that we as a community have helped champion, a combination of robust civil liberties, the protection of minority rights, and an ethos of cultural pluralism. And it deeply complicates our self-image, because we are no longer kept out of university classrooms and country clubs or the halls of government. And in some cases, we have come to be overrepresented in them. Foer points out that between 2010 and 2020, when we accounted as Jews for less than 3% of the American population, one-third of the Supreme Court was Jewish. One-third. And while we, as the aforementioned article points out, may find ourselves in the closing chapters of this golden age, it's also our current reality. It's what we live in now, one markedly different than any other moment in Jewish history. And of course, it's a more complicated picture than what the term golden age might convey. Anti-Semitism has declined, but it's not completely disappeared. And while many of us enjoy the privileges of whiteness, our inclusion in that club has always been precarious, and it truly fails to capture the inherent diversity of our people. And canards about duplicity and money and media control no longer dominate public opinion, but they do continue to fester at the recesses of this country's collective imagination. And the reality is that we are no longer just victims. The reality is that we are no longer decentered. We are no longer forced to scrape by at the edges of society. For the first time in millennia, we have power. And one expression of this power has come through the establishment of the State of Israel and its subsequent victory in the many wars against its neighbors, a modernized and ultimately more successful retelling of the Maccabean revolt. And I want to be careful here. I want to be careful here because I recognize that this picture is also complicated, and it would be impossible to adequately summarize that Gordian knot of hope and loss, of homecoming and displacement, of peace and violence that has entangled the peoples of that land, especially Jews and Arabs. But I'm also not going to shy away, especially now, from the fact that the military capabilities of the State of Israel give us the terrible possibility of actually playing out the fantasy at the end of the Purim story, Lehashmid, leharog, leaved, to destroy, to massacre, and annihilate when threatened by our enemies, the modern-day Hamans, who wish us harm. And I also want to be clear that when I say us, I mean the global Jewish community. By birth or by choice, secular or religious, Zionist or anti-Zionist, we are all intertwined, whether we like it or not. The rabbis write, Kol Yisrael Aravim Ze Baze, all the people of Israel are responsible for one another, and for better or for worse, the actions of one Jew have consequences for us all. In this world, has there ever been a moment like this, the rabbis wonder, when Jews were not only able to defend ourselves, but to do with our enemies as we wished? It's an amazing thing that we can protect our most vulnerable. For too long, we've watched our loved ones murdered, wondering in the tragically prophetic words of the High Holidays, who by fire and who by water and who by sword and who by the inhumanity bred by hatred. And for most of our history, we have been unable to effectively intercede on behalf of our fellow Jews. Instead, we waited for the fulfillment of this awful litany, praying that on the other side of they tried to kill us, we just maybe might survive. I also know that that idea of safety is complicated. It's complicated. The armed police officer at the door of the synagogue helps some feel safe while potentially endangering others, given that dark history of race and power and policing in this country. And the existence of the State of Israel is an incredible lifeline for some Jews, while a locus of anger and grief for others. And safety is also limited. Violent extremists are still able to access our synagogues, sometimes to deadly effect. And 134 hostages still remain in Gaza, and there's no way for us to bring back the over 1,000 dead who were murdered on October 7th. But in the name of this safety, and in the pursuit of our enemies, our Israeli siblings have gone to war, forcing us to ask difficult questions that strain and threaten to break the moral compass of our tradition. How do we define who is our enemy? Is animus towards Jews enough? Or do they need to act on those feelings? What is our responsibility toward the innocent who are near them, especially children? Do we exercise the power to destroy those who wish to harm us? And to what end? These questions can and should animate us right now. It's a statement of fact, and a heart-rending one, that the destruction of Hamas has been accompanied by the death of tens of thousands of Palestinians through gunfire and through bombing and through starvation. And many of us who support the existence of the State of Israel still look on with horror and shame at the images coming out of Gaza right now. So this is a year when that closing salvo of the Purim story might hit a little too close to the heart, which is already so raw right now from the impossible task of holding so much fear and so much anger and so much sadness. We see ourselves in this story desperately seeking the safety of our people in a world that seems to require violence as a response. There's been an emerging tradition to read the verses describing the killing of the 75,000 Persians using a mournful tune, even sitting on the floor. A temporary cessation of joy that asks us to bear witness to the terrible consequences of war. However necessary some of us may consider that war to be, which is itself a conversation for another time. And I want us to consider the question of how you might address this passage when we read the Megillah aloud next weekend. But right now, I want us to sit with how we might respond to this uncomfortable resonance between these verses and this moment in history. One of the lessons of Purim, and it's not unique to this holiday, but it's brought explicitly to the fore in its retelling, is the recognition of how little we truly control. Our heroes, Mordecai and Esther, they're courageous. They're courageous in their course of action, but in the end, they rely on chance and the largesse of others, especially King Ahasuerus, to secure the safety of our people. The book of Esther begins that penultimate chapter with the statement, V'nahafochu, and the opposite happened. Everything we understand about ourselves, each other, and the world can change in an instant. In this case, when our enemies thought they would slaughter us, we killed them. Our history is replete with unpredictability, a succession of events unfolding beyond our control, sometimes for the good, and sometimes with terrible consequences. So how, given all this, can we respond? I truly believe that the end of the Megillah is meant to be descriptive rather than prescriptive. It's a sympathetic fantasy. I mean, who among us hasn't wished ill on our enemies at least once, rather than a recommended course of action? Our answer to the brokenness and the unpredictability of the world is found in a different formula. They tried to kill us. We survived. Let's eat. Truly. Let me explain. For Purim, the let's eat part of this equation is shorthand for giving and receiving life-affirming nourishment, and is broken into four distinct mitzvot. The first is that we read the Megillah. We acknowledge that we do not know what lies ahead, and we never have. We remind ourselves that because we are human, we have the ability to be both victim and perpetrator, depending on context and choice. And this year, more than ever, we must bear witness to that reality, as hard as it might be. But this humbling admonition should not lead to nihilism. It shouldn't lead us to throw our hands up in the air and say, "What can I do?" Because this is a moment of unprecedented power for us Jews. And with it, a responsibility to do something. And that something, that's actually what we have to figure out. That's what we have to figure out. Rabbi Lizzie and I have recently signed clergy letters advocating for a bilateral ceasefire and the return of hostages being still held in Gaza, and a commitment to finding a diplomatic solution for a lasting peace. For the two of us, each in our own way, reading the Megillah this year leads to that conclusion. And we know, given your life, your context, your experience, you might find yourself in a very different place, and that is okay. That is okay. Our tradition has always asked us to wrestle with the hard stuff, but not alone. We do this in community, in conversations grounded in curiosity and compassion. We use the roadmap of our stories to find a way forward together. Second, we give mishlach manot, gifts of food to our neighbors. And this is more than just a goodie bag. It is food shared between friends and acquaintances, gathering around a table to create community, even with those who may challenge us or not think like us, or have responded to this moment in a different way. It is the refusal to allow our fear or our anger or our pain drive disconnection, or to allow disagreement in particular to become the means for dehumanization. Third, we give matanot la'avionim, gifts of our time, of our resources to those in need. We recognize that even if we do not have the power to close the gap between the world as it is and the world as it should be, we are able to help one another. This can be local. You can give money to the many individuals and families who are currently standing on the street corners of the city. You can volunteer at a food pantry. This can also extend beyond our communities as we take the lessons of Purim and apply them to this moment through our advocacy, our activism, and our votes. And finally, we host a suda, a party. I hope I'll see you there on Saturday. We create space for joy. There are those who say that because it is not normal over there, it cannot be normal here. And I agree. This is why the seuda, the party, is a mitzvah, a sacred obligation, because joy is not an act of willful ignorance. It's a reminder of the future we're trying to create. It's the preservation of this precious, life-giving, and deeply human resource in a moment that would destroy it. It's what gives us the courage and resolve to continue the hard work of repairing the brokenness we find around us. It is in the life and death calculus of our tradition, l'chaim, to live fully and unapologetically with whatever time we have. We must be the keepers of joy, especially now, so that when we achieve the future that we've worked so hard for, and I do truly believe that we will see that future, there'll be someone who remembers how to sing. There'll be someone who remembers how to dance, and there'll be someone who remembers how to laugh. Ken Yehi Ratzon, may it be so.
You've You've been listening to Contact Chai, a production of Mishkan Chicago. If you were inspired or informed by this episode, please leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts so that others can encounter our work. And if you appreciate what Mishkan is doing, I invite you to join as a builder or make a donation on our website at mishkanchicago.org. Shabbat Shalom.